Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arizuma Sini and it's a great pleasure opening the new season with our guests, Lori Simmons and Glenn O'Brien. We are here tonight to celebrate the publication of The Love Doll with a discussion and book signing. A tale of disquieting adult fantasy, pleasure and regret, this evocative book is a beautiful chronicle of the artist's photographic relationship with two high-end, human-scale love dolls from Japan. The book accompanies the complete photographic series with the artist's diary entries. Lori Simmons is an influential artist who stages scenes for her camera with dolls, mannequins, and occasionally people to create images with intensely psychological overtones. Her work has been collected and exhibited at prestigious venues worldwide, including the Walker Art Center and Tate Modern. She's currently working on her second feature film and an exhibition of her new work, inspired by the Nico Muley opera, Two Boys, opens at Arnold and Marie Schwartz Gallery at the Metropolitan Opera next week. Also, a solo show of her work will be held at Salon 94 in March 2014. Writer, editor, and creative director Glenn O'Brien writes a monthly column for GQ and contributes to many publications, including Harper's Bazaar. He has created advertising campaigns for Dior, Calvin Klein, and other major designers, and has also written extensively on art with essays and monographs on such artists as Richard Prince and Tom Sachs. His new book, The Cool School, an anthology of hipster literature, will be released in October. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Artist Dialogue Series event, providing an open forum for understanding and appreciation of contemporary art. Copies of the book are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of the program. We have a great audience here tonight, and I'd like to invite all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, across from this building, where you can openly browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of photography and video art. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Thank you. Woo-hoo!
Got it?
Yeah. So let's start with the end paper of the book, which is here. You were 10 years old when you did that?
I actually made that watercolor when I was 10 years old. And I forgot that I'd made it. And I was having a little birthday lunch with my sisters after I completed the Love Doll series, and they presented it to me as a gift, because my older sister who's in the audience is a little bit of a hoarder, and she had saved most of my art, the art that I made when I was a kid, and I had no idea that I'd ever done this. I remembered when she gave it to me, but I was really shocked that the geisha had thematically appeared in my early work.
How did you know about geishas? Were you like a geisha in a former life, do you think?
Well, when I was 10, I think Japanese culture was really bursting on the scene as being technologically, like the world leader, technologically speaking. And my father was in the process of getting all of these Japanese cameras, and we seemed to be learning about Japanese culture in school and learning the dance of the cherry blossom. And for some reason, Japanese culture was, I don't know if it was long enough post-World War II that it was all bursting and starting and people were thinking about Japanese cars, but it really was the kind of our idea of the ultimate in technology and new research came from Japan at that point.
And we had those movies with like William Holden and Marlon Brando chasing Japanese girls around.
Yes, and Loretta Young used to play a geisha on TV, and yeah, there were lots of references, lots of really great references.
So did you think that was a cool thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have also been an influence from Disneyland, It's a Small World, because the idea of a child from every culture was really important, that we were little girls in the United States, but we had counterparts everywhere that were like us, but they wore different costumes.
Were you a doll person?
Absolutely not.
No? You never had a doll?
I was more of a cut off the hair and head kind of doll person. I was a little wild and untamable, and sitting and playing with dolls was just not part of my temperament at all.
Did anyone ever give you a doll? Did you
eviscerate it? Yes, of course. Yes, I was an eviscerator. I'm going to change to a love doll. So
that was kind of a weird time for dolls, because I think suddenly dolls, like, they opened their eyes and closed their eyes and they talked. It was like Chatty Cathy, and they wet their diapers.
They wet their diapers, I was going to say.
They cried.
Mm-hmm. And they started to have incredible costumes. And
did you find that more upsetting than regular dolls?
You mean the fact that the dolls could do things?
Yeah, they could pee and stuff.
I think I was really intrigued by what dolls could do, and I was intrigued by the notion of dolls, but the kind of patience it required to sit and dress and undress a doll, and that was not me. But dolls were just that was what we got for presents.
Yeah.
It's just the way it was.
But you could have traded it for a gun with a boy.
I did play with guns, but are we digressing here?
No, well, no, I just think that it's funny, because I think a lot of people think, well, dolls are there to train girls to be feminine, and, you know, guns are there to train boys to be, you know, militaristic. But my experience as a parent is that even if you never mention the word guns, you don't show violence, the kid's going to get a gun, the boy's going to get a gun, the girl's going to get a doll.
It's true. A boy's going to go like that, and a girl's going to take something and go like that. And it's sort of something that I never would have said before I had daughters, and perhaps before you had a son. And it's kind of unsettling, the you know, trying to unravel and unpack what the cultural influences are that push in that direction. I mean, even being an artist that's used a doll image over and over has been both a fascinating subject for me and a source of embarrassment, because it's like girl play. And it's probably a tiny bit frowned down upon by the culture at large, the idea of girl play.
Did Grace and Lena play with dolls?
Lena did, Grace didn't. But Lena, but Lena would get a chocolate bunny and make a nest for it when all the kids were biting the heads off, and she kept the bunny because she was so afraid of taking a bite out of a bunny, and then she became a vegan. So that's a whole other trajectory of child play, you know.
So how did you find out about love dolls?
I was in Japan in the summer of 2009. I was showing my film, The Music of Regret, and I was with my younger daughter, and she saw an ad in a manga store. We were looking at shopping for lots of manga material. She was interested, and she saw a tiny ad. It was about this big, with a picture of a doll in a schoolgirl uniform, and she pointed it out. And through my gallery there and a number of connections, we were able to go to the Love Doll showroom and shop there, which was Love Dolls, because we haven't really, it hasn't really specifically been stated, but for those of you that don't know, there are sex dolls that are sold in Japan. They're sold in the United States. They're sold in France. But my experience when I discovered the Japanese Love Doll was that it was so beautifully sculpted, so incredibly articulated, that it just kind of, I just thought, I have to have one. So my daughter, who was then 17, and I were taken to the showroom. We went with an interpreter, and we walked into a room with about 40 love dolls in costumes ranging from schoolgirl uniforms to 90s. It was super unsettling.
Were they all, did they all look Japanese?
They all had a kind of anime, manga look to them. I wouldn't say that they looked purely Japanese, but they look like a fantasy, almost like a Japanese American fusion fantasy. I mean, the schoolgirl outfits were the most unsettling part. How deeply embedded the schoolgirl fantasy is in that culture, the plaid skirts and all of that kind of thing.
They sell them here too. I did a little research. The American ones, they all kind of look like Carmen Electra.
It's true. That is so, you just got to the kind of crux of what I perceive, that they're all, that the love dolls here are much more lewd and overtly sexual, and the ones that they make in Japan are much more gentle and kind of pleasing to the eye, unless you like the lewd. And you know. But this is the love doll I just wanted to say on the first day that it arrived, the first day that I shot it, and I like this picture because it arrived in a nightgown with an engagement ring that you could put on the doll and a separate box with its genitalia, which is all in itself shocking, I think.
The genitalia comes separately?
Yes.
Did you attach it?
No.
No? Still in the box?
Somewhere.
Yeah.
That's sort of, and I'm not, it's just part, it just like was the part, and I'm not trying to be, you know, disingenuous or coy, but it's just the part of the love doll that I really wasn't that curious about, which might seem odd, but it's true. I'm going to go to the next.
I wouldn't ordinarily ask how much you paid for something, but how much is a love doll?
A love doll, it depends how involved you get in customizing it, but they can be from $8,000 to $10,000,
yeah,
or more.
And
it's a commitment.
And who buys a love doll, do you suppose?
I'm assuming that there is a pretty thriving, booming business. I'm assuming Japanese men buy them or people import them. There is a documentary that's pretty easy to see that was produced by the BBC. I think it's called Love Me, Love My Doll. It's very, very, very disturbing, and it kind of takes about five subjects who own love dolls, and it kind of goes in depth in their life and their motivation and their relationships. It's a very, very disturbing documentary.
Are they all?
And two of them, I just wanted to say, have contacted me. Two of the subjects of that documentary.
Are they all bachelors?
They would tell you that they're not bachelors because they have between, you know, 3 and 10 love dolls that they feel they have real relationships with.
Oh, so they're polygamous, crazy people. That's interesting.
See, this is the more journalistic aspect of the love doll that I kind of had to investigate or learn about or came with the love doll, but it's like the part that I'm, again, the least interested in.
So you kind of left the psychological dimension in the box, too.
I think so. I think so. I mean, it's hard because people like you always ask the question. And
no,
I
found
it.
I just thought, first of all, I briefly, when I was desperate, worked for Playboy magazine in Chicago. And they had all kinds of weird things in the office. And the editor-in-chief had a love doll, you know, from that period in his office. And it was inflatable. And, mm-hmm, you know, it probably, maybe it cost $100. And it was not very attractive. But I always thought it was for, like, guys that couldn't get a date. But then I started doing a little research, and there seems to be something kind of necrophiliac about it.
I would say that's definitely true, but if you know, if you do any of the research and see the documentary or read any of the interviews, that these men really believe that they have something very real in their lives. And one tries not to be judgmental or refer to things as perversions or whatever, but it was definitely a challenge for me to imagine or wrap my head around the idea of having a real relationship with a doll, even though it conforms so much to my interest in things like Tales of Hoffman and the Automaton Olympia coming to life or the Pinocchio story. There are so many fairy tales and myths and fables that I've been obsessed with that have to do with forming a relationship with an inanimate object. I mean, I've always been drawn to that.
Yeah.
But in real world terms, it's very hard to really sink your teeth into the idea of that. At least that's what I think.
What were you thinking about when you first shot Dolls? That was kind of the first work you did, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the first, I mean, the reason that I put that image in is that's one of the first pictures I ever shot of a doll, and it reminded me of the portrait of the love doll with the ring. And I feel like I've had this, that I've been involved with the same subject since 1976, which is the idea of a woman in interior and the idea of replacing a real woman with some sort of stand-in or surrogate. And the love doll, finding the love doll was just a really incredibly lucky accident that allowed me to move into human scale. But to answer your question, I think my first relationship was to small rooms, dollhouse rooms, and the idea that the camera lies. So I thought, well, if I take pictures of these dollhouse scaled rooms and I make 8x10 black and white prints, you're not going to be sure if you're looking at a real room or a dollhouse room. I really believe that. So as I was buying more and more furniture and buying the contents of more old dollhouses, I was throwing all the dolls into the corner of my studio, just taking them out of whatever I bought at a rummage sale or a thrift shop. And one day, I just took that doll and put it in the picture. I thought, this is weird, but I'll just do it. And the first day I shot, I stood the doll on her head, laid her down in the kitchen, put her in a bathroom, and then when I had an opportunity to show my work, I had two very distinct bodies of work. Now we're in 1979. The rooms without dolls and the rooms with dolls. And when I was showing Helene Weiner at Artist Space my work, I almost didn't show her the pictures with dolls because I was really embarrassed. When I did bring them out to show them to her, she said, I want to show these, not those, meaning the empty rooms were much less interesting to her.
Yeah.
So I sort of feel like they were my secret work, almost like a Morton Bartlett or someone like that. And then Helene Weiner was just really insistent that I take them out and show them.
And why do you think, what's the appeal?
I don't know. I've been asking myself that for, I don't know. I think that.
Is that why you're still doing it, because you haven't figured that out?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably one way to look at it. And I also think that if you can wrest an emotion from an inanimate object or a doll, that it's much more of an accomplishment than actually finding an emotion in a human face. Oops, I'm sorry. Wrong way. Oops. Okay. Oh, it's upside down.
The funny thing about all the ones that I've seen is that you never see women that don't have painted toenails, but love dolls don't have painted toenails. I get, maybe that's their owners take care of.
Absolutely, that's correct.
Yeah.
Makeup and toenails and grooming, yeah.
You think that people who collect these dolls are like sort of closet stylists or?
Well, again, to refer to the documentary, the kind of clothes, I mean, it was kind of horrific, the kind of clothes and hairdos that the dolls were getting, but I just figured that these men weren't trained in these areas.
But do you think they have sex with them?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, that is the function. I have to say, this is the first conversation I've had, lecture publicly, where someone has asked these in-depth.
No,
it's fine.
I just find it amazing.
It is.
I'm surprised they've never done a life-size Barbie. You never worked with Barbie.
No. And I think they did do something that was a really big-scale Barbie. I never worked with Barbie because I felt like so many other people were sort of working with Barbie, and Barbie's so iconic, and you know, they celebrate every anniversary, and they celebrate various outfits, and there are so many books, and I felt like there wasn't that much room for me to explore or kind of mine the Barbie world.
Well, Barbie's also kind of politically loaded, right, because of the anatomical dimensions of Barbie.
The non-anatomical dimensions, yeah. And the fact that Barbie always, the feet were created to stand on the toes, and Barbie could never stand on, I'm sure it's different now, but could never stand on flat feet. So in the first feminist wave, the idea that there was this doll that, you know, had like a big top, like a big chest and tiny little feet and couldn't stand on its own, would just topple over. It was really kind of a negative. It was really sort of a symbol of all, you know, what feminists were really kind of working, a stereotype that feminists were working against.
But she survives.
She survives. It's amazing.
Tom Sachs just did a Barbie slave ship.
What can I say? I'm just going to keep flipping through. You don't have to respond to them as they go, but just to to give you a sense of the love doll and my moving her around the house that I live in.
Did you put makeup on her?
No. Well, maybe a little lip gloss. But I followed this image with this image, which is also one of the really first dollhouse pictures that I made in 1978, because I really love visually getting lost in a sea of blue. And I realized when I shot this that it gave me that same kind of aqueous pleasure that this did. It's like if I can go to a blue place or a yellow place, like color. I love black and white, but color is so important to me. And to feel like that feeling when I look through the viewfinder, like I'm totally encased in a place, like the way Oz was emerald green for, you know, Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, or, you know, that a place can be so blue.
But you obviously dressed this doll and positioned it.
The love doll, not...
No, this one.
No, this is just the way...
That way?
I never dressed a doll. I just, the way it came in the dollhouse or in the package. I mean, the love doll is sort of the first doll that ever needed styling and costume, so that made it really different as well.
But what's she doing?
She's bending over, filling a bathtub.
Oh. It looks almost like that REM dance.
Yeah, right. We can go.
So, the most recent thing you did is with the, are they the medical dolls coming up?
Yes, but sort of at the end, we can kind of fly through the love dolls. But I mean, I can talk about that while I show love dolls.
Well, I don't want to talk too much about the love doll. But
okay.
I don't want to reveal all the research I've been doing.
Well, I'm interested, but...
No, I saw this, you know, this love doll porn, but it's not real love dolls. It's women, like porn actors, actresses, impersonating love dolls. And it's so creepy. This guy comes in his apartment with a suitcase, and he opens the suitcase, and there's a girl in the suitcase. You know, who's completely passive. I found it really...
A real girl?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's pretending to be a doll?
Yes. And they say it's a doll, but it's not a doll.
Do they...
Because she blinks.
Do they wear...
They don't blink, do they?
No.
Okay.
But actually, the second love doll, which we'll come to, has eyes that can... You can move the eyes and move the lids. But I know that there are a kind of group of people that dress up like love dolls and put latex hands and masks on. Is that what these people do? The ones that...
No, but I mean, I didn't really get that in depth. I think I've gone far enough.
I mean,
enough.
This is, you know, in trying to look for props and dolls, it's that kind of exploration is It's where you go. It's what you find, trying to find what the next prop is. And the current prop, which we'll get to, is a medical dummy that I found at a hospital where my sister works. And that's kind of further on down the line. But this is when I mentioned going to a yellow place. Like, to shoot this picture, I would get up in the morning and think, I want to make a yellow picture today, but not know what it was, but then have to search around my house and find a yellow blanket, a yellow shirt, a yellow book, a yellow, any, you know, as many yellow things as I could to kind of create a yellow place. So in a way, the working with these dolls became a kind of just a spontaneous desire to be somewhere or be in a color or be in a feeling or be in a place.
Is she wearing your clothes or?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we started out with clothes from, and this is not to be funny, but she came in a slip, and I had a young assistant in Connecticut where I was shooting. It was the same size as the love doll. And one day she shot, and she was also Asian, and she showed up. She related a lot to she was very beautiful, exact same size as the love doll. And one day she showed up with a suitcase of her own clothes and very shyly suggested that we dress the love doll. And I wasn't ready to do it. So, I mean, I love when things with people I work with or assistants get kind of collaborative in that way. And I just said, okay, well, let's use your dress. Then the next phase was that we would shop at Target. And it was really interesting to shop for the love doll because I thought, I don't know anything about her. I don't know her personality. I don't know what I'm going to buy. So I'm just going to kind of wing it. It's not like buying clothes for my daughters or presents for people. I don't know anything. So it became this kind of another exercise around the work to try to figure out what I was going to buy. I just put this in, by the way, because it's another yellow place from a series in the early 1990s called Deluxe Reading House, but just to give an example of how I like to immerse myself in a color.
So you dressed her from Target. Does Target know that? Sounds like a good fashionate campaign for them.
I sort of like the idea that the love doll, almost like someone who landed from another planet, was discovering things or obsessing about things. And the idea, you know, this picture, I thought, what would it be like to see candy for the absolute first time, but you're older than you just got here and you're discovering candy. So that would be a day when I would wake up and then have to go out and just get a lot of candy to make the picture.
Very Valley of the Dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And what's this?
I wanted to put some jewelry on the love doll, and I went on eBay and I saw an ad for 20 pounds of jewelry. And I thought, what's that going to be? So I bid on it, and I won it, and it arrived, this 20-pound box. I still have the ad. I saved the ad because I thought it was such a great ad on eBay, 20 pounds of jewelry. So that's 20 pounds of jewelry draped. I was working with two assistants, and we just draped the jewelry. And in that case, I took a lipstick and put lipstick on the love doll outside her lips because I felt like she was just a child, almost like the Secret Life of the Lonely Doll, just a child playing in her mother's house and would have gotten a hold of her mother's lipstick and kind of, you know, gone for it.
So how do you think these dolls relate to, like, Blade Runner or, do you think that eventually we're going to have love dolls that have Siri in them?
I actually...
Like an iPhone, you know?
Yeah, I actually do think that there is a futuristic aspect, and that there... Since I started working with the love doll, people have been sending me things about... There was a fashion show, I'm sure you know about this, that sent robots down the runway, and I thought you would know about that. But
no, I've seen Stepford Wives, but
yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah, but, yeah, me too. But I think that there is a futuristic aspect. I mean, these have a very classical sculptural look and feeling, but I think that there is a futuristic aspect to the idea of the of robots and dolls. And even though the idea has been around for so long, the idea of surrogates who would do things for us and perform for us and certainly take care of household tasks and...
Can't divorce you.
Well, that's what the guys in the Love Doll documentary, that's the kind of thing that they say.
But do they, like, you know, if you go to the Love Doll showroom, do people, like, sneak in there, or are they...
You have to have an appointment.
Yeah.
You have to really, you know, it's a very formal kind of, you meet with the owner, and he shows you the dolls, and...
Yeah. But do these guys share their love, I mean, you know, do they say, oh, meet Chico.
Yes. I mean, do you mean in the...
Is it secret, or do they have a life together?
Well, the men in the documentary, and they were from different countries, but they were very, very open. And one in the documentary, one man started dating a woman, and he invited her to a birthday party for one of his love dolls. And he had 7 love dolls at the table and birthday cake and birthday hats. And she tried to be very open about the... his obsession, and in the documentary they said they broke up a week later. I mean, it was like, you know, it kind of followed the notion that people tried to have these characters in their lives and tried to integrate them into their lives, but that other people had a great deal of trouble accepting them.
Is she at work now?
Yeah.
Is she an artist?
Yep. Yes. I mean, when I really get, you know, I've taken so many pictures of them, but when I really get excited is when there are so many pictures that I've rejected, but when I feel like I get a certain element of realism going with them, then I'm really excited about the picture. Like a gesture or something in the posture, or just something that feels really real.
Yeah, that one, she almost looks like she's thinking.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I followed this one with one of the early kitchen pictures, just to reiterate again that I feel like my subject never changes. Like, that was one of the first dollhouse pictures that I ever took. And I feel like the same... that I'm sort of responding to the same visual cues that somehow... I always say I'm like a dog with a bone. I just don't give up.
This one looks dead.
I think swimming, no?
Yeah, well, yeah, or, yeah, floating in the East River.
Yeah. So this is also a subject that I attacked in 1980 and 1981. I shot exclusively underwater. This is one of the underwater pictures. So I've always found that space, that blue space underwater, super appealing.
But these are real people, right?
Right.
But you did do dolls in
I
the
did.
Water
I
at
did.
The same time,
I
right?
should have included one. I did dolls underwater and real people underwater.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I didn't include a doll underwater.
And
I'm sorry. Do you want me to go back?
No. I was just wondering why you did dolls and then what made you go to real people.
I feel like every time, you know, that I'm constantly trying to revisit the idea of shooting real people and seeing if that can work for me. That's if I can get the same sort of thing I'm looking for. And I'm always disappointed. I mean, I always try. And in a way, when I did the objects on legs, I was trying again to use real people. And then it became so hard to make life-size objects that I went back to using dolls again. So it seems like a place that I always go. I experience some disappointment, and I invariably come back to...
But you've done fashion pictures. Were you disappointed in them as well, or is that a different thing?
Well, it depends. Sometimes if I can make, in a fashion picture, if I can make a human feel very much like a doll or very inanimate, then I'm really happy with it. This is the second love doll. It's called New in Box, and this is the way the second love doll arrived. And I actually just, you know, shot the picture not knowing that it would appeal to me as a picture, because I just thought, I was thinking about documenting the arrival of the second love doll.
Yeah.
But it became one of my favorite pictures.
This one's a little more Western looking, no?
Mm-hmm. That's the only naked picture.
And is that a real dog?
Yes. I had a request from my dealer, Jeannie Greenberg-Rowatin, she just kept saying, shoot the doll naked, and I was really uncomfortable. And I thought, I'll try it. Let's just see what it's like. And I was having a really tough time with it. And then my mother's dog wandered through and sat down, and I thought, okay, it can be a Fragonard. It can be, suddenly I could place it in a history of painting that made sense. Suddenly there was a reason for her to be down on the floor, whether she was naked or not. Maybe she just paused to play with a dog. But it seemed like once the dog came into the picture, it wasn't lewd anymore. It wasn't naked anymore. It was nude. And it made me just go on this whole tangent where I revisited every time, you know, a dog and a girl appeared together in French painting or English painting. And it just was this great tangent. Just the dog walking through put me in this whole other mindset. And I ended up really loving the picture.
Did the dog notice the doll? I mean,
well, the true story is that someone is standing out of the picture with peanut butter on their finger.
Oh, yeah.
But the dog didn't notice the doll. The dog just passed through, and it was the moment when we saw the dog. But, you know, we had to do some animal wrangling to make the dog stay in the picture. And this is the only image of the two love dolls together.
Do they have names?
They don't. I mean, lots of the assistants that work for me always, they try to give them names or they ask about names, but no.
They're not allowed?
It's just, they're just, you know, when I'm not shooting, they're kind of big, annoying props. They get put away in the closet or covered with a sheet. Or I don't anthropomorphize them at all. Despite what Walter Robinson said in a piece he wrote about my love doll show, I did not adopt them. They're not a result of empty nest syndrome. I mean, people speculate all the time about what it means to have these props, and it's just, unless something occurs to me years from now, it's just not that, you know? So this is from an earlier series called Color Coordinated Interiors, but again, the idea of two women in an interior, three women in an interior space.
And what are they?
They're plastic dolls from Japan. They were called the Teenettes. And I love them because they were a 1970s Japanese toy maker's idea about what an American teenager looked like. And I love, like, the levels of remove, like, that somebody in another country made these monochromatic dolls and called them teenettes. And they don't look like teenagers. I mean, I don't know what they look like.
They also look more like 1920s or 30s.
Yeah, or like housewives, but they're called the teenettes. That's one other love doll outside in space, just sitting, contemplating. And then this is another series of teenettes in front of, there was another series called Tourism where they're in front of different monuments around the world. So this is from the teenettes are from like 83 and 84. We're getting towards the end here. Oh. So the very end of the Love Doll series, I was sort of reaching the end of what I wanted to do, and I realized that the temptation to actually dress the Love Doll as a geisha was overwhelming me. So I found a small company in New York that comes and dresses people, not Love Dolls, as if you want to be dressed as a geisha, they'll come and bring a makeup person and a hair person and vintage, really expensive, special vintage kimonos and dress you up to be a geisha. So we talked to them and asked them if they would consider dressing up a love doll, and they agreed to do it. And it took, there were three Japanese people in my studio for most of the day. And I really had one day to shoot because they wanted to take the costumes home with them. But it took so long to do the makeup and the wig and everything under the obi, everything under the kimono is layered and absolutely accurate in terms of Japanese, the way it's done. That's another one. So we had a blue geisha day, a red geisha day, and this was outside the house where I live in Connecticut. And that's another outside picture when I tried to use men in 1979. So I just wanted to pop in and express my desire to photograph men, something that I've always tried to do over and over that also sometimes feels like it fails.
These were from the collection of your husband?
That's right. You knew that? Yeah, they were his toys when he was little. That's right.
But are these the Lone Ranger or?
Yeah, but I love the idea that it was the Lone Ranger in duplicate. Yeah. I love the idea that there could be two Lone Rangers and two Roy Rogers or three Roy Rogers.
I went to a bar like that a couple of times.
I know what you mean. So this is the redo of the bedroom, the early bedroom picture, but with in geisha dress. We're coming to the men soon, and I expect you to have things to say about them. And this is the final geisha picture. I discovered that my longtime studio manager revealed to me that she'd gotten a tattoo on her back of a Mako. Maiko was a junior geisha apprentice in training. And I'd been working with the Love Dolls for about 3 years before she told me about her tattoo, and I thought it was just like the most synchronistic, extraordinary coincidence. And she agreed to pose for me, and she posed with the last geisha dress-up, the purple geisha. But it just, it's kind of really amazing that happened, I think.
Is that unusual to have a tattoo like that? I mean, it's not a geisha thing, is it?
No. She's an American girl who has a geisha tattoo.
Yeah.
But I think the geisha, I mean, it's so amazing because she designed it when she was 18, but the face is kind of like Wilma Flintstone or some, you know, cartoon character. And I thought it was just the most beautifully, oddly rendered idea of a, you know, she clearly had the geisha fantasy as well.
And the Yakuza fantasy at the same time.
Okay, you want to talk about Jimmy DeSanta? I popped this in because talk about geishas. I know you wanted to talk about him.
I mean, that's how you started out. You were Jimmy's assistant, right?
No, we were good friends.
Okay.
We got a loft together on Lower Broadway. We're talking about the artist Jimmy DeSanta, and I have his estate. I inherited his estate in 1990 when he died of AIDS. He's also the subject of the photograph that I did called Jimmy, the Camera, the Walking Camera. But his work has been such a huge influence on me because he basically taught me everything I know about photography. So I threw in just a couple of images, and I wish that there was a show. The first real New York show of his work happened this summer at Salon 94, and I wish it was still up so I could direct all of you to see it, but you will be seeing more and more of his extraordinary work.
Well, there's a big spread in the new purple fashion
right.
of his pictures, and also an interview that we did together.
And Glenn wrote a great introduction about Jimmy's work, but this is a Jimmy DeSanta photo. It's really hard to give you a sense of what he did, but that's one called Party Picks. But it was very performance-based, very performative, and also so much about color and creating color with lights as simply as, you know, by simply putting colored gels over tungsten lights. But it really was such a sort of beautiful kind of investigation and dance of color and motion and erotica. But I've been amazed in seeing his work, you know, go public for the first time in so long, how much more poetic it was than I ever realized, and how much less it was about perversion and sexuality, what people thought about it at the time that he was showing in the 80s and the 70s.
But it always had a lot of irony to it, I mean, or wit, because
mm-hmm.
some of them are just, you can't help but laugh to look at them.
Yeah, because he would get people into such, you know, kind of contorted poses,
like that.
And yeah, just like that. But there's so much about the lighting and the composition that I feel like I've absorbed from being around his work or, you know, knowing him and then subsequently managing and archiving the estate.
Were the shots that are like in this vein, were they really thought out ahead of time? Or
I really think that he would take some props and take a model, which was sometimes me and sometimes other friends, and get to a place and assess the situation and think, I see you sitting by the swimming pool and putting this box on your head so that only your arms and legs show, or I see you folding yourself over a rock, or he did things with blow-up love dolls, the kind you're talking about, and he covered one with contact paper and had someone, you know, put their arms and legs up and let it fly. And I think he had this very intuitive, on-the-spot, almost performance response to his props, where he was in his model, and that's how it happened. Like, he would take a model and some marker cones and go to a set or a place and just see what happened. So it was almost like he was recording performance.
Your first work was in black and white, right? So did Jimmy kind of influence you to start using color?
He did, and I thought black and white, and I was so self-conscious about never having studied photography, and I thought, well, black and white seems so real. That's going to make it seem like I really know something about photography. So I proceeded to build a dark room and learn about black and white photography, and he taught me absolutely everything I knew. We had a very long loft. One entrance was on Mercer Street, one was on Broadway. We split the loft. We each had a dark room, and I would go to his dark rooms many times a day to ask him questions or have him help me with my work. And the other thing I did was call something called the Kodak Hotline. They actually had a number you could call with questions. And I called the Kodak Hotline so often that I ended up disguising my voice and speaking in accents because I thought it was like one guy from the Midwest who knew everything about photography. And I thought, I can't call him anymore today. So I got really good at, you know, trying to find ways to reinvent myself so I could speak to this guy. And I remember his voice so well. It was so soothing because I could say, like, what temp? It's really hot. What should I do with the developer? My developer temperature is. He would say, well, you have to get an ice cube and put it in your developer. And he was so calm. But between the Kodak guy and Jimmy, I really learned everything I knew. And then it was because of Jimmy that I started using color, and also the William Eggleston show. Everybody made such a big deal in 1976 about William Eggleston having a color show at MoMA. I thought, like, what's the big deal? It's just color. So that kind of drove me to use color. And then I saw a Jan Dibitz show at Sonneben Gallery, and I asked the guy at the front desk how Jan Dibitz made these works. They were tiny little photographs. And the guy said, oh, he sends them to the corner drugstore to be developed. I thought, that's it. I'm doing color.
But at that time, it was like color was more like fashion magazines and advertising, and black and white was like serious, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was like more modern.
Yeah.
It was, color was sort of modern. And I think people weren't really sure if color was really photography, if it was art. I mean, it's really hard to imagine that a William Eggleston show would get everybody going like that, you know, get everyone so upset. That's the portrait. It was kind of, I made this portrait of Jimmy as a camera when I knew he was dying, and it was kind of an homage to him and also the beginning of a series that I wanted to make. And that's the gun. I mean, there's a cake and a clock and an hourglass, but I just included just a couple here. And that's a ventriloquist dummy that I made in my own image when I was one of the few times I actually made things. And I feel like in some weird way it relates to a love doll, although it was a dummy, you know, it was kind of like a blobby, small ventriloquist dummy that just had a kind of sculpted head.
I wouldn't think of it as looking like you. It's more like Michael Jackson or something.
Yeah, it does. It's a weird one. What always struck people was that it didn't really look like me, but the profile always looked like me.
Yeah.
There are some images, so it was almost like sculpturally there was something right because the shadow looked like me, but the actual dummy never really looked like me.
But you used like Jerry Mahoney and
those kinds of things. So the last thing we're looking at are the medical dolls that I wanted. You know, I'm sure you had observations about.
Well, I think you should just explain how this happened.
Well, I was asked to illustrate I was asked to be inspired by Nico Muley's opera, Two Boys, which is opening at the Met October 21st. And I really didn't have any interest in illustrating an opera or responding to an opera, but there was something. I knew Nico's work, which I loved. I knew it was a contemporary opera. I loved that idea, and I really loved the title, Two Boys. And I thought, aha, another excuse to try to shoot males. And I'd known for a while about these medical dummies that EMS, emergency medical service people, technicians use, and doctors use to practice CPR, practice listening to heart, practice reaching into their throats and checking heartbeats, pulse, all of that. I knew about those dolls, and I thought it might be an interesting time to use them. So I
had you seen them?
I'd seen pictures of them. So my sister, who works in the emergency room, runs the emergency room actually at Lutheran Hospital, got me into the teaching classroom with permission to use the dummy. So I brought some people with me, and I asked someone I know to gather clothes from 2003, which is when the story of Two Boys happened. Two Boys is, the opera is based on a real life story, kind of a macabre story of two boys that had an internet relationship and somewhat of a love affair, and they planned together to murder another boy. Unbeknownst to the older boy, the younger boy was planning his own murder. So the whole thing became very sort of entangled, and I guess Nico Muley was interested in doing an opera about it. The pictures are actually up right now at Gallery Met, but we dressed them in clothes from 2003, brought laptops from 2003, and just I tried to use the light from the laptop to light the faces and just tried. I really had a strong sense of finding a place where I felt a young man goes, like the isolation, the intrigue and isolation and loneliness of the online world, like what that is. And I also tried never to have the two boys in the same picture, because as long as one boy had his laptop, he was always with the other boy.
Did you sort of investigate any of their features, you know, that are used by the medical people?
I would like to eventually, but they're digitally powered, and we weren't allowed to use the digital apparatus. But I'm really curious, because the newer, love dolls, the newer medical dolls can shed tears, and they
have a heartbeat and stuff?
They have a heartbeat, yeah. Which would be hard to show in a still photograph, but knowing what their functions are makes me think about film and video and working with them more. I think there are just two more. I felt lucky because the classroom, the teaching classroom where the medical dolls are, had just enough details that were sort of like generic, like places that the boys might be, a bedroom or a classroom. And I just really loved that one stripe on the wall and the plywood cabinets. And this is a dummy that I had made in around 1992. I did a set of sculptures called Clothes Make the Man. And I dressed them in little boy clothes from the 1950s, because in the 1950s, boys didn't dress like boys. They didn't dress from the Gap. They dressed like men. They dressed like you're dressed right now, when in suits and ties. And so I gathered as many of those kinds of clothes as I could and dressed the dummies. And this was from a series called The Cafe of the Inner Mind, where I gave the dummies thought bubbles. I mean, I gave them thoughts in thought bubbles. And this one was called Chicken Dinner. This is a series that I've shown very little, but I really love.
Ventriloquism has sort of died out, right?
I think it's died out almost from the time that it was born. But it still exists. Like, there is a ventriloquist convention every year in Vent Haven, Kentucky. I mean, it's very marginal, but I remember I went to the Ventriloquist Museum many times, and I talked to the curator there, and I said, how do people know they're ventriloquists? And she said, they just know. And I thought, this is... What more is there to say?
This one looks retired.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I don't know what's next after this, but
film.
No. This is the last still from Two Boys. This is a still. This is a kind of wild card, but this is a still from the feature that I'm in process shooting, which is called My Art. And this is the main character with her students. This is the opening scene of the movie. And
so you you acted in Lena's film Tiny Furniture. Is it hard to direct yourself or to act in something that you're directing?
So far, not. I mean, I have to be pretty collaborative with the other people. Like, you know, like the director, you're not supposed to finish a take when you're a director and go, how did I do? But the people that I work with are very, you know, one of my producers keeps saying, well, it's a very unconventional film. So I just, you know, that's how she presents it, because I have like a regular film crew and I'm working with regular film people. But also, I shot part of the film in May with my students at Yale. I just shot another many, many scenes over Labor Day weekend with my dog, because my dog has actually a quite large part in the movie, and I don't know if he's going to make it until we shoot the bulk of the movie next spring. So I'm sort of like approaching the movie in a pretty unconventional way.
I thought it was interesting when we did the interview for Purple, and you were talking, the character you play is an artist, but she's not you. And you said you were making the work of the character, and you were talking about how you didn't know if you should make it like good or talk about that.
Well, I think the work has to be, and that's really the part of the movie that I'm the most stuck on, is what the artist's work is like, because I am an artist and the work has to be viable. And I think you and I have had a conversation in the past about how no one ever gets artists right in movies. I think we both said The Horse's Mouth was one of the only artist movies that we ever liked. But if you think about all the times you've seen an artist portrayed and how over-dramatized it is, or how, you know, like even the Jackson Pollock movie, we talked about that. The Basquiat movie, you had thoughts about that. It's very, very hard. I don't know what else to say. Nobody ever gets it right. So my challenge is, A, to get a character of an artist right and accurate, and B, to get people interested in a main character in a movie who's a woman my age, because most of the movies that have characters that are with women my age are like the blah, blah, blah Marigold Hotel, I can't remember how to say it, or this idea that a woman, as she ages, becomes more infantilized or silly, or I'm just really frustrated. I'm really frustrated by that. And I really, that's my challenge, is like an artist and a woman artist, to get that right.
So you still haven't figured out what kind of art she makes?
I have some ideas. I mean, it's definitely a more performance kind of art. And it's film, you know, it's filmic. I mean, it's time-based work as opposed to still images. Because the character that our daughter wrote in Tiny Furniture was a photographer, so I didn't want to go there again.
Well, I dared you to make paintings.
I know you did. And I dared you to make paintings. I just don't think I could.
Well, on that note, we do have time to screen your video. Would you like to do that now, Lori?
Well, if we do, I have a clip, just a trailer from the movie that I made in 2006. It's just a 3-minute trailer, which was called The Music of Regret. And I think I was really disappointed that the Music of Regret never found a broader audience. It was a 45-minute film, so it was too short to be a long and too long to be a short. And actually, it was my daughter who said to me, if you want people to see your first film, make a second film. So I've been thinking about that for a long time, and the film was really had an amazing time making the film, and it never sort of lost the desire to make a second film. So anyway, I don't know how we get to it. But,
second. Oh, I'll take care of that. Let me change the lighting first.
Okay. So this is a trailer from the 2006 Music of Regret.
Okay. children liked the chocolate better. I mean, they didn't even touch my cake. I mean, kids just generally prefer chocolate. I just didn't think that I really hadn't noticed that.
You wish you had.
Time to buy a book. That was great.
Bravo. Okay, so let's open up to audience Q&A. We're audio recording the event, so raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you.
Yeah, actually, I have sort of two questions. One is not quite relevant to the art, but I'm just wondering, when you're not using the love dolls, where do you store them, and do you always store them in the same position?
No. I mean, I have my assistants put them away, cover them in sheets, put them in storage closet, wherever, whatever the last position they were in. I mean, I have no... People come over sometimes, and they say, can I see your love doll? And I'm just, yes, but I don't handle them.
Well, that's good. So you really do everything you can to sort of not think about them.
I don't dress them. I don't do their hair. I try to do as much as I can to make them come alive in the photographs. And apart from that.
Yeah. The other thing, actually, it's not so much a question. You may already have been told this, but you know, you referred to Fragonard and the use of dogs in 18th century art. So you may be aware of this already, but you know that the lap dogs had a sexual function.
I actually did not know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, I'm shocked, actually.
Yeah, so when you see, you know, a Fragonard of, you know, a little lap dog in a beautiful young woman's lap, it was intended at the time to be read suggestively.
So it had a suggestion, but not you're saying a sexual function. That's what you said.
Yeah, yeah.
But what you're really saying is it was a sexual suggestion or sending a message.
Well, I think it was understood pretty literally. I mean, I don't want to get too graphic, but...
Is that your area of expertise?
Yeah, that's... Yes, yes.
Okay.
Erotic pets are my... Okay. It's been my whole life devoted to that.
I totally defer.
Yeah, no, but it's actually, you know, something that's known by people who study the period. I am involved with earlier art, actually.
Before batteries were invented.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to get too specific, but I guess you get my drift.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Well... Teddy bears are kind of static, so, you know. In any case, I just didn't know if you knew that, but
no,
I thought it was worth
not,
mentioning.
The running mic.
I didn't come prefigured with this, but while listening to your discussion, recently I've been reading the Eastern tradition. That there's a tradition of people realizing our enlightenment. You know, we all know about that. It's not that big in the West and hasn't been. But when you were talking about the love doll and that documentary where these men have a relation with these dolls, and it's clearly an illusion to others looking at it that they have this illusion of relatedness with these dolls, or a child with a doll or a teddy bear or something, we look at it and we see that it's an illusion of relatedness, that it really isn't. But when you read this tradition in the East, and there are many books like the Lankavatara Sutra, the Ashtavakra Gita, the Avadhuta Gita in Advaita Vedanta and in Buddhism, when people have realized or become enlightened, their confession often is that us separate egos walking around, that everything is just pure consciousness, that us separate egos, that's an illusion of relatedness. To them, in that state, I know nothing of this personally, but you can read about it. And it occurred to me when you folks were discussing that there's even a profundity in your work in that way, or for me, it was being triggered by what you were saying.
I mean, I know something of what you're speaking about, and that would be amazing if there was any connection there. I mean, thinking about the men again and their relationship, they're so profoundly fixated on these objects and, you know, transposing them in, I mean, in psychoanalytic terms, they're projecting like crazy. There's transference, there's projection, there's...
But it's kind of like the new physics, like these chairs seem to be objects, but actually they're just atoms. They're like photons jumping.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are running out of time. I just wanted to close with the last question, Lori. Would you talk about the book and the process of making the book and the special paper and all of that?
Well, everything, I mean, I feel like everything that's great about the book, I mean, I had some diaries that I kept and I had the pictures that I made, but everything that's great about the book is the result of the fact that I was able to work with the designer Richard Pandicio. And that's something that I'd wanted to do. I'd approached him about doing a book years ago when I did an Aperture book, and that didn't work out. But I feel like the book is so... Richard selected a material for the cover that he felt like would relate to the latex of the doll. Richard convinced me to use the orange and blue colors as a kind of opposition of East and West. And I said, Richard, I can't. Those are my high school colors. That's just like... And then he presented me with a whole bunch of other colors, and I realized that those were the perfect colors. I had to see all the other colors to know. And I just feel like I just feel like I've made some books, but I feel like this is the most beautiful book that you know, was a result of that collaboration.
Yeah, the whole project is gorgeous and very striking. And thank you so much for this most entertaining discussion. It's now time to move on to the book signing.